From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made in November 1986, the first time that Western New Yorkers elected Louise Slaughter to Congress. She won a tight election that year, 51-49% over incumbent Fred Eckert. And for the next 13 elections, Ms. Slaughter was never really challenged, dominating every contest in double digits handily. For her 15th term in Congress, it was much closer. She was finally pushed again, but she won, defeating Republican Mark Cassini last fall, Slaughter winning re-election by 871 votes in that case. And so now she's wrapping up her 29th year in Congress. She's fought for expanded health care coverage, women's reproductive rights, among many other things. And she's here for a good portion of the hour to take our questions and yours. And I want to get right to it and welcome Congresswoman Louise Slaughter back to Connections.
Great. Thanks, to have Evan. You here. I'm happy to be here.
Well, I want to start on security issues. I want to kind of go sequentially because we've seen a number of international incidents, but of course, domestic incidents. Starting with, if you want to pick a point, Planned Parenthood, the attack there. And you have spent a good portion of your career wanting to protect reproductive rights. Who do you blame for that?
Well, let me tell you what Planned Parenthood does, and it's been a whipping boy for such a long time. But one in five members of the public get their health care from Planned Parenthood. It's not what they do on choice is done separately from the funding that they get from the federal government. Not a dime of that is used for abortion. But what they do is cancer screenings, HIV screenings, breast cancer screenings. They don't, you send them to radiologists for breast cancer, but the incredible work that they do because it's free. And men and women take advantage of Planned Parenthood. It is the major health contributor for one in five Americans. And what in the world is wrong in the United States of America now that they don't want people to have health care? We've spent the last year since we passed the what we call Obamacare, and I'm happy to do it. He worked hard enough for it. And remember, every president since Teddy Roosevelt had tried to do it and fell short. So my native state is Kentucky, and no state in the country benefited more from that health care program than Kentucky did. In eastern Kentucky, with black lung and other diabetes, tuberculosis, things that people had, had really gone untreated. And the governor decided that he would accept the federal plan, but he would call it Connect, K-Y-NECT. And so nobody knew that it had anything to do with the federal government. It's the strangest thing, isn't it? I found it during the Clinton health care plan. I started getting letters and calls from people asking me to keep the government out of their Medicare. I was absolutely flummoxed that they didn't know that that was a federal health care program. Social Security, the same way. If you've been on Social Security for 4 years, you've gotten back every dime you've paid in it, and you are now drawing money from people who are working at the moment. That's how Social Security stays going. And I just am very much concerned now when I see the Americans, what they're thinking and what they're believing.
And so what we saw in Colorado, again, this was a man who attacked.
It was awful.
Yeah, and he cited he wanted to be a warrior for the babies. He cited some of the recent rhetoric. But do you blame the people behind the rhetoric, or do you blame the person behind the attack?
I will tell you right now that he spewed the very same phrases that were said by people in the Congress of the United States and other people in that organization. Now, I've since learned that there is a real pushback taking place now in states. Colorado is going to be one of them, and counties. There are places all over the country where this constitutional protection, and I want everybody to understand that choice is protected as a part of the constitutional rights of the United States.
Are you worried about that going forward?
No. They have never made the least bit of attempt to do anything about the constitutional protection. They just fire up people and send them off. And without their information, most times when I talk with people who don't believe in Planned Parenthood, they don't understand that it is a constitutionally protected occurrence. And they really don't have that knowledge, and that's too bad.
But you and I were talking before the program began about how things do feel polarized.
Yeah, more, indeed.
Do they feel more polarized now than your first year in Congress?
But it's not just that. I will tell you what's worrying me. Great. I'm very much concerned about the United States. we had a great to-do here over a vote that I had wanting to beef up visas. Since we had that, they have discovered that Tashfeen Malik, who came in to marry the young man who was here, Mr. Farouk, mm-hmm. Was interviewed 3 times personally, was interviewed twice with the State Department and Homeland Security, and nobody ever knew that she had been on Facebook saying jihad was good and she wanted to be a part of it. Now, my government now is beginning to wonder if they should be tightening up on. She came in on what's known as a fiancé visa.
She wasn't a refugee, though. There's a difference.
No, she wasn't. No. But they found 2 refugees in Finland. I don't know if you saw this. They came for asylum. 2 boys from Iran and or Iraq, I believe. Mm-hmm. 2 twin boys. And somebody very sharp there in intelligence realized they had seen them before. They were pretty unusual, identical twins. And they had pictures of them killing 11 prisoners laid on the ground as they walked by and shot them in the head. And they were asking for asylum in Finland. A lot of them really trying. But I want us to tighten up. I raised up my hand and swore to protect the people of the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic, and I'm going to do the best I can for it. I just don't see how our intelligence is working on those issues. They had no clue about what's going on at San Bernardino. I have been told that neighbors in that complex where they lived said that men went in and out of the garage where they were building pipe bombs night and day. And yet, again, nobody told anybody or nobody had any idea, nobody had any clue. It's just not possible.
Okay, but in the question of refugees, that's different than Tashfeen Malik. And with Tashfeen Malik's case, the question was, can we flag social media comments or do we have a way to search them using keywords, et cetera? And maybe that will change.
I think we'd better. Okay. I mean, for heaven's sake, if the woman said on social media, jihad is good, I want to be a part of it.
Then we should know?
Absolutely.
Okay, right. So
absolutely.
So that's one thing.
Know.
Then the question is,
how are we going to keep, look, 14 people died, 21 in the hospital.
And it could have been a lot more.
Don't you think?
Absolutely. Sure.
Well, I understand they had something bigger in mind. So how can we say we're keeping Americans safe if our intelligence is that poor?
Okay. And that I think that that is not exactly the same, though, as the question on what do we do about refugees. I mean, I understand the overlapping concerns. But the question is, are we providing enough security also in a humanitarian fashion? And the White House has said, President Obama has said, he didn't like, not only does not like this bill, he's disappointed in the 47 Democrats, you among them, who voted with Republicans, the White House is saying this is going to make it even harder for refugees who are dying.
No, you know, I've pointed out to you already that people trying to get asylum in countries have bad records and are part of the Islamic Jihad. And I think that a little safety for us to do that, we might have been able to keep her out of here if we were able to do that. And 14 people would be able to celebrate the holidays with their family. I mean, we have to think about the damage that's being done. It's not something we just pass over. And certainly, this is a country of refugees. I'm a member of the Helsinki Committee and have been for 40 years. I have gone into Turkish prisons. We went into Soviet Georgia and to get people out of jail. I was in Central America shortly after I was elected, and it seemed that everybody there from Washington State was in jail. And Jay McDermott from Washington and I managed to get most of them out. So I've been working on this all my life. I don't take a back seat to anybody. But I really want to make sure, given the fact that what we know about people coming across in this mass migration, which is pitiful, and I'm grateful very much for the countries that are close by to take them, and we hope that we can get them settled. But I wish, as I look back on it, that we'd had a no-fly zone over parts of Syria so that people could have had an enclave there and they could have stayed. I watched those children. Nobody's ever going to forget the picture of that little boy on the beach. And it is heartbreaking. The migration continues, but I think that we have to be careful with what how we're doing this.
So the president disagrees.
Well, I don't care.
But do you think
he's
being...
I disagree with him more than
once. Oh, no, I understand that. But what I'm asking is...
I wasn't elected to go down there and agree with Barack Obama.
I think everybody agrees
with
that. But you're elected to be yourself. But the question
is... No, I'm elected to represent 750,000 people in the 25th district.
But do you think the president is being soft on this issue right now when we need to be firm?
I believe he thinks so because he went to the Pentagon.
I mean, is he being weak on this?
No, he went to the Pentagon today, and they're studying now as to whether they should tighten up on visas. Now, I think they should have known that a long time ago. And frankly, as we saw what happened in France and how efficient they were at finding most of those people, except the ones they think escaped now to Switzerland, we don't do that well. It's awful because our intelligence budget, we don't even know how big it is. It's part of the black budget of the Pentagon.
Now, if I know you, you're going to laugh at this question, but what do you say to people who want to know if your vote on the Syrian refugees is tacking towards the next election?
No, absolutely not. I probably lost votes on it, Evan, but I contemplating the thing, going to classified briefings where they literally told us they couldn't protect us. I mean, and they've said that in open meetings in Congress.
I'm just wondering, if they're telling you that in classified settings, then why is the White House pushing for...
You'll have to ask the White House.
Yeah, okay.
I wish you would.
Well, I would love to ask
Because I will
the White
tell
House.
You that I think a lot of people are rethinking that whole issue now.
Okay.
Particularly after what happened in San Bernardino.
Okay. Now, before I get to a few phone calls with Louis Slaughter, who's here with us for half the hour today, she's got a busy schedule. You were out this morning talking about a very different issue.
I brought a press release on it.
I'm just trying to catch up on this as fast as I can. We talk
this
a lot about education and STEM issues. And what Ms. Slaughter is raising this morning is the idea that there is gender discrimination.
And indeed there is, and there has been all along.
What's going on?
When I got out of college, University of Kentucky, the master's degree, I had paid the same tuition, bought the same books, and went to the same classes and passed the same courses as everybody else that was graduating. But as a woman, the minute I graduated from that university, I was worth 59 cents to the dollar of what the men in my class were going to be paid. And it was some determination that at that point in the 50s that we might get married and just waste it all or what I think. But we are continuing to this day, thus this report, to denigrate the fact that women scientists are not being given the same mentoring, the same opportunity at grants, the same pay as men. We're looking to see whether those applications should be gender neutral. Over $17 billion a year is given in scientific grants to universities. Part of that agreement is that agencies are supposed to make sure that they're gender neutral. We're not asking for anything special for women. We're asking for equity. And I'll tell you, every American should understand now, since almost both parents work in every household, that if the woman is paid less than she is worth for that job, comparable worth, it cheats the family.
So what's one thing that could change to make this better then?
We want to make all those agencies that are supposed to and have never done it to keep track of those grants and where they go and make sure that women are not being discriminated against by the numbers they are. We can tell, for example, that the average grant for a woman scientist is $435,000. The average grant for a male is $1 million. It's not the difference in the kind of work that they do. It's just the way we have been treated in this society.
We can't
waste half this. We are the majority in this country, and we can't waste that brain power.
We've talked about your scientific background.
Yes.
If I could go back to the time when you graduated and you would have known then in 2015 that these would be the numbers, would you have been shocked?
Yes, because one of the first things that I did when I got to college, first I have three daughters and two granddaughters. And Bob and I decided a long time ago we didn't want to see happen to them what happened to me and all the other women in my cohort. Yes, I would have been shocked. When I first got into Congress, I think in the late 80s, I discovered that at National Institutes of Health, a young Chinese investigator, scientist, had her lunch tampered with. Can you imagine? Think about that, right? And we got into it pretty deeply and found, that women were not invited to the proper hearings. They were not given the same opportunity they should have to apply for grants. They didn't get invited. They weren't mentored. And I wrote an amendment which passed the House, but not the Senate. The Senate took it out. So I was really stunned, frankly, again, to hear from a woman scientist at Yale who was really the impetus for asking for this study. Three of us asked for it, Congresswoman Rosa DeLauro from Connecticut and Congresswoman Eddie Bernice Johnson from Texas. And we're serious here. The brain power cannot be wasted.
All right, let me get to the phones. This is Jenna in Pittsford. First up with Congresswoman Louise Slaughter. Go ahead, Jenna.
I have to say it's so nice to hear Congressman Slaughter. She has such a sweet way of talking, but I just have to clarify a couple of quick things. First, on Planned Parenthood, she slid in there about the cancer screenings, talking about how Planned Parenthood does cancer screenings, mm-hmm. but they, in fact, don't do mammograms.
And we need to no, they don't do mammograms.
Excuse me.
Certainly.
Because that's an important distinction that the public does not understand when they talk about the importance of Planned Parenthood. They really sort of outlived their usefulness. And let me be clear, completely clear and transparent.
What, mammograms
I
have?
I took a girlfriend of mine for an abortion to Planned Parenthood when I was a senior in high school. Mm-hmm. And I believe at that time it was an important choice for her and it was the right choice for her at that time. But we were horrifically attacked by anti-choice opponents. At this point in time, at this point in our life, one of the things that is not discussed is that we can keep kids on our insurance till the age of 26. Obamacare is in effect. Mm-hmm. Medicaid exists. Planned Parenthood has effectively outlived its usefulness to the point that they don't provide comprehensive medical care for women, number one. Number two, when you're talking about the intelligence and how it's failed us, it has failed us across the board. It's failed us in Benghazi.
Yes.
And people are dying. Our soldiers are
yes.
dying. We do not have rules of engagement that effectively protect our military, and that has got to be addressed. When you talk about the mass migration and keyword searches for social media, et cetera, mm-hmm. if we had that in America, hundreds of people would have been saved from McVeigh. We're not just talking about Islam and its I know I'm speaking quickly because I'm sure you have other callers, so I apologize.
No, it's all right. I'm happy to hear from you.
For me, I was in Massa's district when he was expunged, I'll use that word, so I couldn't speak to you because you didn't handle my district. But when McVeigh killed Americans, and as Evan knows, my family is Muslim, okay? So for me, the phobia that's taking over our country and the focus that's consuming Congress right now, to me, it's distracting. It's like the shiny little object. Let's focus here instead of how do we keep our country safe?
All right, Jenna.
And my brother, who just retired from the U.S. Army and was in charge of the Pacific Rim for air defense, his job was to keep our country safe.
All right.
And to me, we should be looking at it globally.
Thank you, Jenna. Yeah. Thank you, Jenna. Louise, go ahead.
I'd like to comment on things. Planned Parenthood may search for lumps, but if you're going to have a mammogram, your own doctor will send you to a place where it's good. And we've
sure.
been really blessed here with Wendy Logan and the wonderful work that she's done out there. She's an expert in mammograms. So that's really not a fair knock on Planned Parenthood.
But she says they've outlived their usefulness.
I don't believe so at all because they're free. And there's still so many people in the United States that have to have medicine that is free, health care that is free. And maybe she does know that. But this is not... There is, if you're talking about a focus on Muslims, that is really not the issue. Islamist jihadist is an issue. But I have been part of, as I said, for Helsinki Commission, been to Bosnia, marched on that, Somalia, the wars that we fought. For Muslim populations, I've supported every single one of them. I don't look at them as Muslims. I look at them as Americans. If they live here and they are citizens here, they are as much a citizen as I am. So there are some political campaigns that are taking that on, but don't think that that's focus in Congress. It hasn't been at all. The focus in Congress has been, frankly, on just trying to kill health care for reasons I can't quite, never could accept. But they do want to take health care away from people.
All right, let me get to Trudy in Rochester. And let's keep it moving as quickly as we can. We only have a few minutes left with Louise Slaughter. Go ahead, Trudy.
Thank you so much for taking my call. I'm talking about the refugees. I just came back from Germany, and I'm from Germany. My family lives
mm-hmm.
there. And I saw so many refugees. Now, my question is, when is the U.S. Ready to take refugees in? Since Bush actually started the whole situation in the Middle East.
Yes.
He is responsible. And, you know, our neighbor Canada right now, Trudeau, the new prime minister.
Justin Trudeau, yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he received refugees at the Toronto airport. How mm-hmm. nice. The mayor from Montreal received another batch of refugees. And, you know, when are we ready? It's not Obama's fault. It's the Republicans. And, you know, when you are in Germany, all what you hear, how do we take care of all these mm-hmm. people? By the end of the year, they're going to have 1 million. And Germany is the size
yes.
of the state of Montana. And it isn't Obama. Obama tries very hard, but it's the Republicans. You know, and you wouldn't want to hear what they talk about Trump in Germany.
No.
I mean, they can't believe that we have a man like this running
I can't
for
either.
Office.
Well, Trudy, let me let the congressman jump in. Go ahead.
No, I can't believe that either. I think they've never mentioned Congress. You know, they talk about building walls and all the kinds of things that they may not understand that Congress would have to appropriate the money to do that because they never mention them at all. I hope that this will turn out well for us with this election. In my view, John Kasich and I were friends in Congress back when he was chair of the Budget Committee, and we worked
well
together.
He's not going to get elected, though.
But he's not going to get elected, no. And it's really troubling to me to see what the majority of people in the country believe and what they feel. We have failed somewhere with messaging, and people have accused Democrats of that forever. We are very proud of what Angela Merkel has done. No wonder she's the time a woman of the year. And Germany has really done well. There is one, the difference that people are walking across or floating across to come into countries around around Europe, which is easier for them to do. But to get into Canada, obviously they were brought over. And I think we will do our part. All I want is for us to be secure and to have a feeling for a change that we knew what we were doing. Honestly, the meeting today at the Pentagon was stunning to me. It was really amazing to me to see what this woman had gone through, and nobody caught a thing.
Talking about Tashfeen Malik.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, I have to tell you, that is the greatest example of somebody announcing to everybody in the Middle East that she's a jihadist and coming in here on a marriage visa, and nobody picked it up.
Now, Justin Trudeau in Canada decided no single Syrian men.
Mm-hmm.
They're allowing essentially families, young children, etc.
And we can do that, too. Absolutely, that's prudent.
Do you think that's something we will consider?
Yes. I do.
You do, okay.
And that was not really part of what we were talking about.
No, sure, no, right.
No, we were talking about trying to keep people out who meant us great harm.
All right, so I've got to wrap up with Louise Slaughter. She's got a busy day.
Listen, it's great. I'm going to go over with the governor, and we're going to congratulate ourselves on getting designated for the upstate Renaissance. So I can't
$500 million upstate.
$500 million. On top of the money we got in for photonics, we're going to really rebuild this economy, and I'm very proud of that. And that's why we need women in STEM to be recognized, too.
I want to extend an open invitation for you to come back whenever you like. We say that to all members of Congress.
Mm-hmm.
And we will also, to be as we get closer to election seasons, we'll make sure for people who are saying, well, I want opponents to have equal time. We'll do that, too. Will you be running again in November?
Yes, I will.
Of course. And so I hope to see you many times.
All right.
But thank you for the time. And for the audience who couldn't get through, this was just one of those cases where the congressman only had a half an hour. But we will make sure that we come back with a full hour for her.
Absolutely.
And for you. Thank you, Lucy.
You're welcome. Thank you.
All right. Short break and more connections. We're turning to Preet Bharara and the question of corruption in state government next. Coming up in our second hour, we learn all about the brand new Boomtown Table. It's a kind of online magazine that covers all kinds of issues related to agriculture locally. Food, trends, ethics, politics, drink, and more. Boomtown Table, some of the writers and founders joining us in studio next.
Support for your public radio station comes from our members and from the Wealth Strategies Group at Canandaigua National Bank and Trust, offering financial planning strategies that are tailored to clients' needs. Canandaigua National Bank and Trust, investing in you.
Maps show us the way. They also show us what's in the mind of the map maker.
The thing that separates all the different map makers apart is really their style and what they decide to leave out.
A visit to a room that holds the largest collection of maps in the world and a new book featuring over 3,500 years of cartographic innovation drawing on a range of cultures and traditions. Later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
This afternoon at 4 on WXXI.
Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Just want to remind our audience once again, this was simply a case that the Congresswoman said she had to do the half hour instead of the full hour just because of her schedule today. And we have no shortage of phone calls and comments from you. We're sharing those with her. If you couldn't get through, we've got emails and many other comments that we'll share with her offline. But we want to do that online on the program again soon. And Ms. Slaughter has said she's going to be happy to do that. So we have we've got a freestanding open invitation for all members of Congress to come on this program, engage with us, engage with our listeners without conditions. And we're glad to say many of them do that. And we're going to continue to do that going forward. All right, let's shift to a state-level government issue. And for many of you, if you've got questions or comments about what's been happening in Albany, our next guest is going to be able to help us sort through that. Karen DeWitt, our Capitol Bureau correspondent, on the line with us because we are talking about state government and corruption. And Karen, for those who haven't been paying attention, there's a lot been going on in the last few weeks. How are you?
Yeah, hi, Evan. That does seem to be my beat lately, right? You describe it succinctly, state government and corruption. It's been a stunning year. I'm thinking when we started off, almost a year ago, January of 2015, the Assembly Speaker was Sheldon Silver, and the Majority Leader was Dean Skelos on the day that Governor Cuomo gave rather a late State of the State. I believe it was January 21st. They were still there. They were commenting on what the governor was saying, both of them thinking that they were going to be in the legislature and in power. And one day after that, on January 22nd, Sheldon Silver was arrested on major corruption charges. Dean Skelos was arrested in May, and we've seen play out in the last couple of weeks, both of them convicted on numerous corruption charges in federal district court in Manhattan, and they have both lost their jobs because of that. And, it was expected that they would probably be found guilty, but it's pretty stunning that these very powerful leaders, they're gone less than a year.
And so, Karen, in a moment, I'm going to play a clip of Preet Bharara, the U.S. attorney, speaking this morning on WNYC and Brian Lehrer's program. And so we'll hear that in just a second. If you missed that this morning or want to hear Preet Bharara in his own words, we've got a chunk of that in just a moment. But at least now, Karen, we don't have to sort of tiptoe around. We can actually talk about Sheldon Silver and Dean Skelos and his son and use the word corrupt, and that's a legal definition now, isn't it?
Well, that's true. That's a good point, because it was alleged, but the juries did not think so. They found them guilty. I should mention, though, that there is going to be a lengthy appeals process, and we have seen major political figures get off on appeals in the past, including a former Senate leader, Joe Bruno, who was convicted on the federal honest services law. Then the U.S. Supreme Court kind of tweaked that law and narrowed it, and Bruno was exonerated. The U.S. attorney for the Northern District brought charges again, trying to prove bribery, and Bruno got off. I mean, he spent a lot of money, could never be a politician again, but he didn't have to go to jail, and he was ultimately exonerated of all charges. So it's possible that that could happen with both of these leaders when it plays out through the appeals process. So we have to watch for that, and that's going to take years.
I suspect, I suspect if you were to ask them privately, I would not be surprised if they both are convinced that they will win this eventually, not only because of the experience of Joe Bruno that you just mentioned, but because it seems to be this inculcated culture that this just happens and this is what we do. And I would suspect they think that this will turn around for them.
Yeah, I think they hope that a judge is going to be sort of more impartial and just on the facts than a jury, because they, especially in the Silver case, the U.S. attorney didn't actually prove bribery. There was no quid pro quo. There was no smoking gun. Yet the jury was like, this is, we can really see that this is wrong, so we're going to convict him. But a judge maybe just looking at the letter of the law might be, you know, say, well, this case didn't really hold up. Another clue is the fact that neither of these guys mounted an actual defense. They didn't call any of their own witnesses. They just they cross-examined the witnesses for the prosecution, and they had closing arguments. But that was about it, which makes you think they are, you know, holding their powder for the appeals process.
Well, let's listen to Preet Bharara this morning talking on WNYC and Brian Lehrer's program in New York City. This is the U.S. attorney, and then we'll come back and talk to Karen DeWitt. And if you want to call the program or weigh in any way, we will take your calls as well. Here's Preet Bharara.
You gave an example to the Times over the weekend of a systemic problem. You remarked on a piece of testimony by State Senator Tony Avella in Queens, chairman of the Senate Ethics Committee. What did he say under oath exactly?
He said, among other things, that he, although he is the chair of the Ethics Committee, he's never been permitted to have a hearing. He's never marked up a bill. And that's just part of, I think, what came out of the trial and what people know as a matter of public record. Everyone has their part to play in making sure that we have honest and clean government. The prosecutors have their part, and I think the men and women in my office have been doing their part. But and the public has a role, and the press has a role, but also the politicians themselves have a role in self-policing. You know, any institution can have bad apples in them that need to be prosecuted, whether it's on Wall Street or at banks or anywhere else. But the first line of defense against bad conduct is the institution itself, and it seems, based on Senator Avella's testimony and a lot of other information, that they're doing a pretty poor job of self-policing.
The Times refers to you today mentioning outside income, lack of transparency, and that concentration of power you were just talking about as underlying causes. The system has been nicknamed Three Men in a Room, referring to the governor plus the two positions that you've just found to have corrupt leaders. But is this unusual? Don't the Speaker of the House and Congress and Senate Majority Leader and other leaders of legislatures have similar powers, or do you think that something is really different in New York?
Well, if you just look at what has happened in the last couple of weeks, you see how extraordinarily different it is. And I know there have been corruption cases brought against members of the United States House and Senate as well. But just imagine in America what would be going on and what kinds of reforms would be on the table and how large the outcry would be if in the space of 13 days, the Senate Majority Leader of the United States Senate and the Speaker of the House of the United States House of Representatives were convicted of unanimously convicted of every count in a series of public corruption charges. I think there would be a big outcry. And I think the Congress itself would begin to realize it needed to step up. You know, that hasn't happened there, but it has happened in New York.
Do you think lawmakers should be full-time with no outside income allowed rather than part-time and looking for work the rest of the year as it is now, which a lot of people believe contributes to the conditions for this kind of corruption?
Yeah, you know, I think that a lot of things should be discussed and should be on the table. I don't want to promote any specific reform, but there is something to be said for the fact, based on our experience in bringing these cases, it's a little bit harder to get away with bribery. It's a little bit harder to get away with extortion if there are more strict limits on outside income. And common sense will tell you it is much harder to disguise a bribe or a kickback as a referral if you don't have the ability to have the same kind of outside income. But again, I understand that there are arguments on the other side as well, but I think it's really something that seriously should be considered.
That's Preet Bharara speaking to Brian Lehrer of WNYC this morning. I see the phone starting to ring, and we'll get to your phone calls in just a moment. Karen DeWitt, that's the first time that a lot of people have heard Preet Bharara since the prosecutions of Sheldon Silver and Dean Scalise. So what do you make of that?
Well, I think it's interesting, the point that he's making, that these essentially weren't just bad apples, like kind of lone wolves
right
out there doing crazy things. Essentially, Scalise and Silver, they were the legislature. Now, some of the audio tapes that were in the trial, and one of them I used in one of my radio stories, is where Scalise kind of rants, "I have all the power. I control everything." He's kind of bragging to his son. That's pretty much true. They do control everything, and they really are emblematic of the legislature compared to the other members that have much less power, and, you know, presumably they don't have the power to get in as much trouble as these guys did. But it's systemic. It's not just a couple of people, and we have seen a number. I refer to Senator former Senate leader Joe Bruno, a number of Senate leaders have been indicted, jailed, convicted, including John Sampson, Malcolm Smith, Pedro Espada. It's a long list. And, you know, you just got to wonder, and I certainly wonder that as a reporter, you know, when is it going to change and when is this going to stop?
Well, and that's what Mr. Barrera told the New York Times as well, that just because two of the three so-called men in a room were taken out in these corruption trials does not mean that the problem is fixed if it is indeed systemic. And you heard him just tell Brian Lehrer, for goodness sakes, the people supposed to police it on the inside, the ones running these committees who are supposed to be able to convene hearings, they can't even do that. How do we get to that point?
Yeah, I should probably know the answer to that.
Well, I mean, that was more rhetorical. That was more rhetorical anyway, because I don't think anybody does know.
I know. I'm just saying, though, it's a good question. I mean, there's a lot of things going on here. As I just said, you know, Senator Scalia's bragging that he had all the power. The rank-and-file lawmakers are pretty much powerless. Even the committee chairs don't have a lot of power. The legislative leaders actually hire the staff for the committees, so they don't even have control over that. And I know when I first came here, it was the late 1980s, and I would interview committee chairs and the Ways and Means Committee chairs quite frequently. And over the years, I stopped doing that, and I thought, well, was I naive at the beginning to interview them? No, they did have more power, maybe even, you know, 25 years ago, and slowly they have less and less power. And I think if the power were more diffuse among the assembly members and senators, it might be harder to consolidate the power at the top, where you have a situation where everybody has to jump because your son needs a job, as was portrayed in the Dean and Adam Skelos case.
Right. And, you know, just witness how quickly both parties and both chambers moved to replace Sheldon Silver and Dean Skelos, Hastie and Flanagan. There was almost no talk at all of, well, before we replace these men, should we think about reforming the very power structure that has created this notion of three men in a room? And Joe Morelli, the Assembly Majority Leader, has told me he thinks it's a little unfair that we use this three men in a room, that it's not quite so lopsided, et cetera, and that it's been caricatured in the media. What do you think, Karen?
Well, they do. The leaders did go back to the members when there's a big decision to be made and get their input, and former Speaker Silver was better at that in the later years. So they do. But at the same time, these guys do have all the power to go into the closed door room and make the deals. And I think that's a fair characterization of what's going on there, honestly.
All right. Karen DeWitt is on the line with us, and we're going to get some of your questions and comments as let's go to the phones. I will remind our audience, I always think of Karen as the person who does know everything. She'll tell us what she can tell us and no more, because there's a lot of what we don't know about what Preet might be planning next. And I think that's John's first question. Go ahead, John.
Hey, Evan. Hey, Kate, Karen. Yeah, you know, we've got two out of three. Now the third man in the room, will he go to jail? That's the next question, because of his conduct and possible criminal conduct in the Moreland Commission dissolution. And also, he's being investigated in Solar City, a $750 million project in Buffalo. There's a lot of issues that Governor Cuomo might be the third rail that goes to jail. What do you think?
Thank you, John. Karen, go ahead.
Well, I don't know the answer to that. No one at the Capitol knows the answer to that, but it's pretty much all anyone at the Capitol talks about anymore.
Oh, really?
Because especially since these convictions now of Skelos and Silver, and as the caller mentioned, we know that Preet Bharara has been looking into Cuomo's Moreland Commission on Corruption that he abruptly shut down, and questions about awarding of the contracts for the giant Buffalo Billion Solar City project in Buffalo. We know that he's looking for something, but will he find it? That's a big question. I think there's pressure on Bharara now to go for the third person, or at least some of the high-up aides around Cuomo. You know that he's trying, but we don't know how that is going to come out. But certainly that's something that Governor Cuomo has to contend with, and maybe a reason why he spent very, very little time in Albany and is trying to talk more about national issues like gun control, because it's sort of this cloud hanging over him, and I think that starting in 2016, as the curtain rises on his State of the State message, which we just found out this morning is going to be January 13th, there is going to be a shadow and there's going to be a lot of questions about that. So whether the governor did something wrong and is going to get in trouble or whether he's done nothing wrong, he's still going to essentially have to kind of suffer for this.
Well, and Karen, before I go back to our callers, I just think of two things when it comes to the idea that maybe Mr. Barrera will go after Governor Cuomo in a similar way. I think, first of all, you know, I don't know how much, and I don't know the law in terms of what is illegal and not when it comes to Moreland. I do know that Governor Cuomo is very plainly either lying or being very cynical when he now says Moreland was never supposed to be independent and prosecutorial. In his own words, it was independent and prosecutorial. And he does apparently think he can just change the record by saying it. And that's very interesting to me because, you know,
the media has tried to call him on that. We all sort of jumped on that. But yeah, he does. Well, I mean, he does that with a lot of issues, honestly. If he kind of likes to rewrite history or say it in a different way if it wasn't flattering to him. But this one, people really flagged as kind of a glaring error
right.
in what was really happening.
Right, there's no nuance on this one. And then I go back to thinking of the movie A Few Good Men, and is Tom Cruise going to ask Jack Nicholson's character if he ordered the code red? I wonder if Preet Bharara thinks, I'm only going after the governor if I really feel like I've got it and I will win. Because that would be a different kind of fight.
I agree, absolutely. If he loses, then he looks bad. So he's got to make sure he has a good case, if one exists.
Yeah, if one exists. And Karen and I are not sitting here saying that we have a corrupt governor, that we have a provably corrupt, not at all. We're simply saying that right now a lot of people are wondering, is there a third domino to fall? Preet Bharara was asked that about 16 different times in 16 different ways on Brian Lehrer's show this morning, and he said, no comment and don't read anything in that. Don't read it as probably yes or probably no or anything other than no comment. So we know nothing more from Preet Bharara about that. Back to the phones we go. Bud in Chilai is next. Go ahead, Bud.
Well, I have two questions. First one is a rhetorical one. If Sheldon Silver was guilty, who are the people that were feeding him the money or whatever he was getting? Would that include any local real estate people? And the second one is that I and another former Kodak employee placed complaints at the Attorney General's office 4 years ago with court records, and it was put in the circular basket, or at least the non-active basket. That was before Cuomo was elected governor. You cannot get an answer out of anybody. I would be glad to talk to any news person in this state and give them so much information, their head would swim. And all you have to do is say, contact me, and I would.
Well, Bud, you know, we hear from people all the time. We'd love to hear from you via email if you've got something to share with us. And I would say, absolutely, please do. So
yeah, please put it down in writing. We'll take a look.
Sure,
at it.
There you go, Bud. And but on the first point he was making, he said it was rhetorical, but he did ask, are there any local connections to Sheldon Silver? And the answer I have to that is not that I know of, but I don't know. Karen,
it was a New York City real estate firm that he was involved with, and the law firm that Silver was of counsel to down in the city. So
okay.
not really anything beyond that. But.
All right. Here's an email from Mark. Just wants to know, does Karen think that Preet Bharara is actually running for governor? Karen?
Oh, maybe. He says he doesn't want any higher office, but, you know, Rudy Giuliani started as a federal prosecutor and ended up being, you know, mayor of New York City, presidential candidate. So we just always assume that they have political ambitions.
Isn't it the
certainly
best?
Certainly, he's burnishing his record if he wants to run.
Sure, isn't it the best optics for him to say, "I didn't even want it, but I've been dragged into it because the public needs me." I mean, that's the best optics.
Well,
that's true.
I mean, if he said it now, then people would just see everything through that lens.
Sure.
As, oh, he just wants to be governor.
Sure. Let's see here. Bonnie in Rochester is next up with Karen DeWitt. Go ahead, Bonnie.
Yes. Hi. A couple things. One is, I think some of these things also reflect on the fact that we have this real problem with a so-called two-party system that's really two-party, one-party. We all do the same thing, just we have different names. The kind of approach that we have had for years. And I think, you know, especially the lack of a real strong position from progressive third parties that, you know, would probably play a check and balance more on this and make and have some of these things more solvable, more visible, more transparent. So I think that there's a core piece right there that's very important. The second thing is, and this is maybe a little off the subject, but one of the fears I have is I know the issue of the having a statewide constitutional convention is coming in the next year or so. And I'm very concerned that as important as these issues are, and again, there's other ways that we should be solving them, as I was just saying, that what clearly will happen is we could kind of just use all these kinds of missteps and bad things to have the convention. And for me, the biggest danger of these things is to for us to threaten those things in the Constitution that assure people who are in need of the rights and services that New York has always had in their Constitution. So
but Bonnie, a question for you. Are you there, Bonnie?
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay. Are you saying that even on the state level, or are you saying that on all levels of government, there's really not much difference between Republicans and Democrats, which are the two main parties in power?
Well, you would think if you look at the primaries on the national level, you would say, you know, of course, there's a bunch of
huge differences.
You know, trying to get you know as much coverage just to look like buffoons all the time. So you know, if you factor in that, of course, it all you know looks like differences. But when you look at what happens on a more ongoing basis, and I'm not saying there's absolutely no ever differences, but they are so close. There's the whole thing with corporate. I mean, Governor Cuomo, you know, half the time you don't know which party he's in because he acts on both sides. If it's convenient for him to look like he needs to be more conservative, he'll go that way, and then 2 days later he'll say, you know, you can't, you know, in other words, people that should be standing for things that are more progressive, and you know, that's a longer conversation, of course, often are just so, everything's so mishy-mashy, and it's hard to have people who will stand up. Therefore, when issues like this come up, the power things, you know, everybody feels they've got to, you know, put their power piece first.
All right, Bonnie, thank you. Karen DeWitt, do you see...
Well, the comment I would make is it's true that the parties in power and the legislature do stick together, and one big example is redistricting, redrawing the district lines. Even though Republicans have controlled the Senate and Democrats have controlled the Assembly, they allow the other party who's dominant in the House to just draw the districts to favor the party in power. So there is quite a bit of that going on. They realize this is something in our common interest. So she is right about that part of it.
Sure.
And the Constitutional Convention, it would be very interesting if they held one, but usually people are afraid that something they don't agree with will get passed. We would need a change in the Constitution to go to a full-time legislature, and that would be one way to do it. But the way the Constitutional Convention works, you have to vote several times through the process. I don't think we could even have one until 2018 or 19, which is a little bit of a ways off when the problem with the corruption is kind of hot and happening right now.
So, in other words, in if history is any guide, there's a lot of talk and noise about a constitutional convention, and the fear of what it might produce leads to it not being held at all.
Well, they haven't had a successful one since the late 1930s, so that's been a while.
All right. Well, so Karen, before I let you go here, just some final thoughts on the question of Mr. Bharara and corruption and ethics. You know, it is going on 2 years running now that we've seen Governor Cuomo come out at some point during the legislative session and pronounce that we are now the most ethical legislature in the state because of new rules to make it tougher. Mm-hmm. And yet you are seeing Preet Bharara, you're seeing others now saying we have to do things somewhat differently, that the system must change, et cetera. Is there any ethics reform kind of package coming up at all? And if there is, doesn't it sort of risk invalidating all of that rhetoric we've heard for 2 years? Or do you think that this will now largely be ignored, that those prosecutions are over, the governor's going to go on with his work, the legislature will go on with his work, and they'll try to think about Preet Bharara as little as possible?
Well, I think they'd like things to go that way, and it may very well. I think we'll see some more incremental reforms proposed, and that's what they've been doing for years. Like, oh, you have to disclose a little more of your income, or you can't use your private campaign funds to do this action, but still you can have outside income and you can, and your campaign funds are pretty much yours to do what you do with it. The governor's just been it's been kind of a losing issue for him, ethics reform, and I think he doesn't want to get involved in it. He's going to be dragged into it a little bit, but he's blaming the legislature right now, saying they have to reform. And he said a few days ago he doesn't see any appetite for some for major reforms in the legislature, kind of putting the blame back on them.
Karen DeWitt, as always, it's wonderful to have you on this program. Our listeners love hearing you at length on this format. So thanks for answering their questions and ours, and we'll look for your reporting soon.
Well, sure thing. You're welcome.
Karen DeWitt, Capital Bureau correspondent, and such a treasure for WXXI and our community of listeners here and across the state. All right, short break here, and we're coming back with a story of Boomtown Table, an ambitious new project that just launched, and you might not have heard of it yet. You're going to hear of it next.